and listeners from around the world, welcome. I'm Henrik de Palmgren. We are glad that you have tuned in to Red Ice Radio, headquartered on the Scandinavian Peninsula, Northern Europe. Our website is rediceCreations.com. Over a year of shows available that you can stream or download. The first hour, sometimes both, is always available for free. We had a full program the second hour and all previous shows going back to our start in 2006, available on rediceMembers.com. Go there to sign up and tune in to all the shows and videos that we have there for you, over 900 programs as of right now. You can also find us on YouTube and Stitcher. We used to be on iTunes, but as you might have heard already, Apple censored us a couple of months ago. They removed our feed from their podcast listing. So we recommend that you add our podcast manually in your iTunes software. We have the instructions on our website. Just go to our RSS feed podcast page and you'll find the instructions right there. We have an extended segment with Brian Hooker for you today. This is the gentleman who was instrumental in making sure that we, the rest of the world, could get access to the information that the insider at the CDC, Center for Disease Control in America, spoke about in regards to the known vaccine autism link. And this is what we'll be speaking about today. Dr. Hooker has a distinguished career as a chemical engineer, managing a large-scale systems biology research program at Battelle Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington. Since 1995, he has served that laboratory as a senior research engineer, a staff engineer, and a principal consultant in biotechnology. He also taught chemical engineering at 3 years at Tri-State University in Indiana and teaches at Walla Walla Community College in Washington, in addition to operating his own consulting agency. He has a long listing of research grants, scholarly technical publications, awards, and formal presentations, and he is co-owner of several patents. Our focus today is on the issue of vaccination safety, the statistical rise, the epidemic of autism in children, and how the media and the pharmaceutical lobby have tried to do character assassination on Brian since he started to speak out about these issues, and especially since he spoke with the CDC whistleblower. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for coming on today. Hope you're doing well. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on the show, I appreciate absolutely getting the opportunity to tell your audience about what has gone on and what is going on with malfeasance at the CDC.
Well, certainly. I mean, this is a very important story. We've talked about it with other guests in the past, and it's kind of a story we've been following, really, for many, many years, how this is the tremendous corruption that has taken place within the medical establishment and everything else. And, of course, you're a key figure in this recent story of the CDC, the insider speaking out and everything else. And, we've been very interested to watch how this has unfolded and how you've been instrumental in helping to facilitate the insider speaking out, if you will. But before we get more talking in about the latest details and what has been unfolding, tell us about your story just a little bit and how you got involved and I don't know if you got dragged into it. What's your background here, Brian?
Okay. I have a PhD in biochemical engineering. I got my PhD back in 1990 from Washington State University. And I have worked in the biotech industry. I've worked as a researcher. I've worked as a professor. I'm now associate professor of biology at Simpson University. I've published over 55 peer-reviewed scientific publications. So, I've got a background in science and I know, I know scientifically how to get, how to get my work published. I've done work in genetic engineering, environmental restoration, and, most recently, epidemiology and statistics. But the reason why I got involved in this is, my own son, Stephen, who is now 16 years old, was injured specifically by his 15-month vaccines back in 1999. And he had a fever reaction to his DTaP, his oral polio, and his Haemophilus influenza vaccines, and then subsequently lost all speech. he was talking before that period of time, lost all eye contact, and just sort of went into his own little world, and was diagnosed with autism then in 1999, very, very soon after his vaccine injury, and then was diagnosed, you know, as vaccine injured. We had, my wife and I had connected the dots pretty early on, but then when he was about 2.5 years old, then we had a doctor, a very good doctor that stuck with us through the years, who confirmed that. So, you know, I've got skin in the game. I, you know, have experienced this firsthand. And since that time, then I've looked at some of the scientists that is being put out by the U.S. government and primarily by the CDC. And with my background, I've been able to look at their statistics and realize that there's something extremely fishy going on here.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's to say the least of it. It's been so many examples of young people that have been hurt, children, babies that have been hurt by vaccines, and the continued kind of cover up, and the fact that they refuse to recognize. How is, when you've been, you know, talking about this, how's the pressure been on you? And I've done little searches and tried to figure out, and it's really divided. There's people who are really supportive of the kind of work that you're doing and talking about this, and then of course you have a tremendous pressure, not only from the medical establishment, but also from a lot of people that think that it's more harmful, you know, to not let the kids have these vaccines, etc. They're really pressuring there. It seems like it's very much divided in that line. Wouldn't you agree, Brian?
There is a deep divide, and it is extremely contentious. I do not Google my own name anymore because I see some of the things that have been written in the blogosphere about me. One blogger accused me of being a 9/11 truther, which is absolutely false. So there's an extreme amount of hyperbole. They attack me. They attack my institution. The majority of it, you know, in terms of the attacks is vicious ad hominem attack. I wish that, you know, when we have these debates, that we could stay on the issue and yeah. We could look specifically at the science. But unfortunately, and some of these bloggers are funded, you know, directly, the money is channeled from the pharmaceutical industry directly to the bloggers, and they are paid, you know, specifically to go out and oppose me and write smear pieces about me. And, with the story heating up, recently, because of the CDC insider that I ended up talking with for, you know, about 10 months before, you know, he was brought to the public eye. Because of this, you know, some of the attacks have been, in mainstream media. So, you know, I've been attacked by ABCNews.com and also CNN.com. They've written, you know, essentially hit pieces.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it's been a little odd. I've had to avoid it. There's been a lot of pressure on my family. I tell my wife not to look at any of these things on the internet. It just because, you know, they can be extremely disheartening.
Oh, I know. I mean, I didn't mean to bring it up in that way. You're right, though. I mean, let's kind of just stick to the issue at hand. There's always this kind of mudflinging and guilt by association that starts up, but that means that there's something to it. People are very emotionally upset about these kinds of issues and stories when it comes to the forefront because it's so important. That's just it. And I'm with you on that page. Let's just get this out in the open. Let's talk about it. Let's bring all the information to the table so we can make true determinations. I mean, they're children's and you know, adults, for that matter, too, lives at stake ultimately here, and the health of a lot of people that are getting these vaccines. That should be the issue here, right?
That is correct. We need to talk about the science, and we need to look at conflicts of interest. You know, when you look at publications that are done by the U.S. government, the U.S. government has a stake in individuals, you know, specifically infants getting vaccinated. They have a strong stake, and they actually have a financial stake in it. So you can't just look at the science and you can't look at it at face value. You have to be able to understand that people have conflicts of interest, people bring their own biases to the table, and anybody that says, well, I'm an unbiased, I have an unbiased scientific opinion, is usually false. You know, they're either deluding themselves or they're lying. You know, I when I talk to reporters in the past, I say definitely I have bias. You know, definitely there I bring bias to the table.
Yep.
Because of my own son's condition, it's very, very difficult for me not to have bias. Now, even if I have bias, I can do good scientific work and I can tell people, look, take my science and, you know, hold it up to the light. And unfortunately, that is not happening throughout this debate. Unfortunately, there's a lot of hiding and there's a lot of lying going on in this debate. And so it's very, very difficult for people to get good information.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Tell us about the CDC insider, how you guys got in contact with him, how you ended up talking with him for, you know, over that long of a period. And did he know that the calls were recorded? Was he fine with that? Tell us about the story.
Sure. Well, the story actually begins a long time ago. Back in 2002 and 2003, as a scientist, I was directly contacting and talking with CDC researchers. And one of the CDC researchers that I was talking to was an individual by the name of Dr. William Thompson. And Dr. Thompson and I had several phone conversations throughout the course of those 2 years. At first, they were collegial, and then I started to ask some really tough questions and pointed out some flaws in terms of the science that the CDC was purporting was correct. And then, you know, there was a blackout in 2004. I was contacted by CDC attorneys. I was told by them that I could no longer directly call CDC scientists. And if I did call, that the CDC scientists would not return my calls or return my emails, that my only, you know, my only recourse was through the Freedom of Information Act. And the reason that they cited at that particular time was that my son was participating in, you know, the U.S. National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and then, according to them, essentially suing the CDC, which was patently false. I'm not suing anybody. The National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, that's, you know, commonly called Vaccine Corps, is a no-fault program. So, you know, to participate in that that program, you're not really pointing fingers at anybody. You're just saying that a vaccine injury has occurred, and you want to get compensated for that vaccine injury. So in 2004, everything went dark, and I subsequently, because my only recourse was the Freedom of Information Act, I have submitted over the years over 100 different FOIA requests directly to the CDC. And when I've submitted those requests, then it, you know, takes about 2 or 3 years, sometimes as long as 5 to 7 years, then I would get information. Now, and there's, you know, that's a story in and of itself, but to get back to the whistleblower, in November of 2013, I received a phone call, and I looked down at my cell phone and looked at the caller ID, and it came from a 404 area code, and I realized that that was probably from the CDC. And I didn't pick up. I've received some, in the past, I've received some uncomfortable anonymous phone calls from the CDC that were, you know, harassing in nature. So I knew I didn't really want to pick up the call.
Right.
And the individual that called, did not leave a voicemail message, but my curiosity got the best of me. So I ended up calling back. And the individual who called did not pick up, but I was sent to his voicemail, and it was Bill Thompson. So, you know, I was very, very curious. I emailed Dr. Thompson and, you know, asked him if I could help him out, why he had called, and he apologized. He said that he had called me in error. I don't really think now that that's true. But we did end up hooking up on the phone, and we over the series of 10 months, what he laid out to me was gross malfeasance in out-and-out fraud in the CDC.
Yeah.
You know, it started out, the conversation started out very safe and very benign. He was trying to tell me about ways that I could access CDC data, and he described methods where I could basically go through the front door of the CDC, request specific data sets that were associated with different studies that the CDC had completed regarding vaccines and autism, and I did that. So we continued this relationship. I was receiving data. He was coaching me on how to analyze data. And then when these, you know, compelling relationships between vaccines and autism were coming up that the CDC had completely hidden, then he would then describe how it was hidden. He, several times he affirmed, yes, the CDC got the same relationship that I did when I was doing my analysis, but instead of bringing it to the light, then they would choose to, you know, either use dubious statistical methods to make it go away, or would out and out cover up the relationship.
Now, is this something that you could have seen on your own looking at the data, or did you need him to, you kind of interpret it for you?
Really both. There were some things that stuck out, but that I knew were not in CDC publications, specifically the relationship with the timing of the first MMR vaccine and autism incidents in African American males. That stuck out like a sore thumb. But then when I called Dr. Thompson and talked to him about that, his statement to me was, "Oh, you found it." And
right.
So he affirmed, and I said, "Well, you found what?" And I found what? And he said, "You found the relationship." And he described how in his some of his earliest analyses, and this was back in 2001, for this particular data set, that he had brought up the relationship between MMR timing and autism in African Americans. And he described a scenario where he was specifically told to break protocol. He was told by his superiors. This was three different officials from the CDC. And then he basically said, you know, all this was done behind closed doors. There was no record of the conversation. But I was told to do what I could do to dilute out the statistics so they would not have to report this relationship.
Right, exactly. Now, I don't know how complex the data is or how much of it there was. Was this something, according to the insider, the whistleblower, that's been going on like across the board all over the place, or was this just kind of limited to this one 2004 study primarily, you know?
Dr. Thompson stated that he received pressure across the board to not report statistically significant relationships that showed adverse events between, you know, coming from vaccines and vaccine components. So, and he described specifically instances regarding the MMR vaccine, not just limited to the effect in African American males. And he also talked about their different studies regarding thimerosal, the mercury-containing preservative that is was in many vaccines that were received in the United States in the 1990s and early 2000s, and now is still in the flu shot that they give to pregnant women.
Yeah.
So he described these relationships specifically, and his overall assessment was because the CDC, because of so much pressure that came from the top down in the CDC not to report these relationships, that the CDC had single-handedly set autism research back by 10 years.
Yeah. Who is calling the shots on something like this, deciding to cover this up? And if, you know, if there is anyone talking about this, specifically Dr. Thompson, obviously, but is there any reason behind this? Is there anything that's been revealed as to why they're so adamant about putting the lid on this thing?
Well, to answer your first question, like I said, the mandate to not report these relationships came from the top down, and it, in some instances, was as high as the director of the CDC, who at the time was Dr. Julie Gerberding.
Yeah.
Then her direct subordinates, Dr. Colleen Boyle, who is now the director of the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, Dr. Marshall and Jürgen Alsop, who is the head of the Developmental Disabilities Branch of the CDC, and Dr. Frank DiStefano. These were all co-authors on the MMR study. Not Dr. Gerberding, but then also Dr. Stefano, who is the head of and was the head of the Immunization Safety Office. So this was really coming from the top, and it was coming from management. And what Dr. Thompson explained to me was that the CDC had a very gross conflict of interest, because the CDC buys the vaccines that are distributed in the United States, by and large, you know, not all of them, but the majority of the vaccines that are distributed in the United States are bought by the CDC directly from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and then the CDC distributes those vaccines to the state public health departments. So the CDC was taking taxpayer money, and they were buying $4 billion worth of vaccines every year. And so not only were they pushing uptake because they have, you know, what I consider a very illogical fear regarding the spread of infectious disease, but they were also disseminating and promoting the uptake of vaccines just so they could recoup their cost.
Right, right. So do you think that that's the primary incentive here? There's so much money, such a huge industry that even later down the road, even if they are to a certain extent sincere about their, the science that they believe they got their hands on, that they realize that it's just too much of an issue. So it's easier to cover it up, let's say, than to begin to say, whoops, it turns out it's actually an issue with these vaccines, because that would kind of blow the lid of the whole thing, wouldn't it?
That is correct. And, you know, one of the things that happened, if you look at Dr. Gerberding's career, you know, she was the director of the CDC, I believe, from 2001 until 2009. Then she went on to become the head of the vaccine division, the vaccine production division at Merck. And so she had a pharmaceutical industry job waiting for her when she was done at the CDC. I think due to government restrictions, she wasn't able to go directly to Merck, but she had to wait a year. But then she ended up going into the vaccine industry. And many other scientists at the CDC have taken the same path. So, you know, you have this revolving door between vaccine industry and the CDC. So it's very, very difficult for those scientists to go on the record and say, yeah, there was a vaccine adverse event. In fact, regarding thimerosal, there was one scientist, Dr. Thomas Verstraten, that when he published his study, he was no longer at the CDC. He was at GlaxoSmithKline.
Yeah.
And he was working on CDC studies. And that was a huge conflict of interest. This was regarding thimerosal-containing vaccines. And GlaxoSmithKline was a defendant in a lawsuit, and actually I think several lawsuits at the time regarding thimerosal. So he had no business doing this type of research.
Tell us more about the science here then, and the vaccine autism link, and I guess to kind of address those who would be skeptical about this and say, I don't know about that, you know, because it's an established organization, they're the government, they have our best interests at heart and all that kind of things. What would you say to those people?
Well, I would have them directly look at the science. The CDC relies on, regarding the thimerosal-containing vaccines, the CDC relies on six different studies that are supposed to indemnify thimerosal regarding the autism epidemic. I've gone through each of these six studies. I actually published a review article where I critiqued each of these six studies. It came out in July of 2014. It was in the journal Biomed Research International. And each of these studies were either fatally flawed or duplicitous, and most of them were both. You know, most of them, there were definitely methods that were used to hide the relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism. And in some cases, in case of the CDC came out with a study that was done by Christopher Price. It was published in 2010 in the journal Pediatrics. If you actually looked at the background data and you looked at women that received the thimerosal-containing flu shot when they were pregnant, some of the data suggested that those women were 8 times more likely to go on to give a birth to a child that would regress into autism.
Yeah.
So and these were these were not data that were diluted down. These were just out and out hid from the public. And so, you know, based on this track record, I don't think that the CDC has a leg to stand on regarding the veracity of their studies.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the CDC would never repair from something like this. And, I mean, there's a lot of potential lawsuit waiting in the wings of these kinds of things. And it would just be, you know, too much for them to bear. I think they just have to, their only strategy to this extent is to continue to cover it up, which, of course, takes me back to, Dr. William Thompson again. Is there... Do you know anything more recently about him? I mean, is he still working there? Is that okay? I mean, I would reckon that he would be targeted for the fact that he's been talking about this, right?
Well, interestingly enough, he's still working at the CDC, to my best knowledge, and has been ever since the whistleblower story blew open and his name was identified as the whistleblower from the CDC. He's been going to his job. He's been working. I have not had contact with the whistleblower for the past 2 months. So, you know, I think that at the best advice of his attorney and at the best advice, of his family, he has just decided to go dark. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of pressure. He would like to save his job. And, you know, since that's a possibility, then I can understand that. And also, I do know that he is cooperating with members of Congress in order to turn over the information. And a lot of the information that I've received already and some information in addition to that to congressional representatives so they can conduct their own investigation. So that, you know, the work is continuing and the whistleblower is – you know, even though I'm not in contact with him, I'm encouraged that he's working with members of Congress.
Now, is that what it takes to blow this open, do you think, of get an investigation? I mean, I'm always suspicious of organizations that are designed to self-examine themselves and kind of look at themselves, and there's a tendency there for obvious reasons that they wouldn't be sincere and honest in that process. We know that the pharmaceutical lobby is very, very strong in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of money here. So can we trust that the government would audit itself on this kind of matter?
Well, I would have to say time and again, when we've looked at the government trying to audit itself, it has been a disaster.
Yeah.
And so I hold out hope that this would be different. But, you know, there have been investigations into the CDC in the early 2000s by the Burton Committee, Burton when he was chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And that report came out and was scathing, you know, against the use of thimerosal in vaccines and its connection to the autism epidemic. But then nothing happened. And then there was another investigation that was done by the Senate Health Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and it was done by Mike Enzi. And the pharmaceutical lobby stepped in, and nothing happened. In fact, the report that came out was this sort of edifice that just defended the CDC and said, look, there's nothing to see here. And it was diametrically opposed to the Burton report. And then back in 2012, there was a hearing. Representative Issa did a hearing on the federal response of the autism epidemic. That hearing was originally supposed to look at CDC malfeasance. It did not. And it turned out to be this huge dilution of effort. Nothing came from it. And so, you know, the track record is not good.
No, it isn't. That's just it. Now, let me ask you this, because I don't know what you stand on this. We've talked with many different people in terms of just questioning vaccines in general, would you say that the basic science of inoculations is sound, but we're only in this case talking about the additives, the preservatives and things that are added that are unnecessarily added in the vaccines? Is that the primary problem, or is there something more fundamentally wrong here, do you think, Brian?
I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that vaccines are administered, specifically in the United States. I'm not as familiar with other countries. I know that the United States vaccination schedule, specifically for infants, is much more aggressive. And children in the United States receive about 49 separate needle sticks by the time they're age six. And so I think it's just too many. It's too soon. And the vaccination schedule as a whole is just understudied. There was one study that came out in 2013 by Frank DiStefano, who is a CDC insider who came from the vaccination industry back into the CDC. And it was basically a window dressing they looked at the supposedly the entire vaccine schedule and its relationship to autism, but it's literally the worst study I've ever seen. I've never seen something as duplicitous and as poor quality in my scientific career, absolutely. And so, you know, this is what the government puts up and says, oh, there's no problem with the vaccination schedule, but it's the type of study that, you know, a ninth grade math student would be able to unravel in a period of 15 minutes.
So how is that? I've always struggled with trying to figure this out because we have a lot of, you know, science buffs out there. They're all about looking at this, you know, numbers and everything. And it's like usually I come to this realization there's actually nothing wrong with the science per se. It's the fact that people it's bad science, yes, and it's published, but it's just that the people don't actually look at it. It's more that they trust the authority that says that it's safe, and then they actually do not look at the real studies. But if they did, they would realize that something is wrong with it. So how does that work, do you think? Because there's so many people out there that are very much, they kind of abide to the authority of the CDC and say, if they say it's okay, then it's okay. And it's all about just kind of trying to discredit those who are questioning those the results that are put out in the studies that themselves, right? So how does that work, do you think? What's the psychology behind that?
It's very difficult to say. You know, the loud mouthpieces regarding the safety of vaccines and that would, you know, purport that the current vaccine schedule is safe are really not qualified to look at this research. I mean, you look at, you know, sort of the industry mouthpiece, Dr. Paul Offit, who is I think he's head of pediatrics at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he is adamant that vaccines are safe and effective and adamant that he has no conflict of interest, even though he holds a patent on one of the rotavirus vaccines and, you know, stands to get millions of dollars as children receive this particular vaccination. But he's unqualified to look. He's an immunologist. He's not qualified to look at the statistics and the epidemiology. You know, he can't say. And he was shot on camera saying that, well, vaccines, you know, thimerosal has been cleared in the autism epidemic, and that's due to the Thompson study that came out in 2007. But when you look at the Thompson study that came out in 2007, it didn't even consider autism. So, you know, a lot of these individuals, and, you know, I could go on. There's another individual, Dr. Neil Halsey, who always is, you know, erring on the side to assure us that vaccines are safe and effective, that there's no problem here. And yet he does not have the ability, you know, his scientific background precludes him from looking at the statistics and saying this is a reputable study or this is a dubious study. And so, you know, and you see these individuals when they talk, they commit these horrible blunders, but they will come out and, you know, basically die on the hill that regardless of what the science says, vaccines are safe.
Yeah, it's definitely a hurdle. So you said 49 vaccines by the time most children are age six. That's then a lot of things. What actually happens here then? Is it there's many different reactions that could occur. There's many different you know, side effects, basically, and there's a number of things that could happen. But is there such a thing as it accumulates in the system, specifically with mercury and whatnot, so we can see a kind of a change occur almost, in some cases, what I've been able to see anyway, instantly almost, or the next day. Child is perfectly fine, and then there's like a saturation point almost, and boom, and then the brain is affected immediately. How would you explain what occurs here?
There is a toxic tipping point in these children, and when they reach that particular tipping point, then it is, you know, this perfect storm that sets up events that ultimately causes neurological injury. In some individuals, in the case of my son, when he received his vaccines, he had an active ear infection and was running a temperature, which is contraindicated, but the healthcare professional that was working that day that gave him his vaccine said, you know, that's fine, you know, it's not a problem whatsoever. And he was having chronic ear infections, you know, throughout that particular time. So that really set up a perfect storm for him. For other children, they will receive, several vaccine antigens in the same day, and they may have, some type of metabolic disorder like a mitochondrial dysfunction. And what we're seeing in children with autism is that a significant portion of those don't have, you know, the mitochondrial energy. They have specific mitochondrial defects. You know, the mitochondria are the energy production factories of the cell. And so, you know, when these individuals fever, they encounter multiple vaccine antigens, you know, like the MMR vaccine and the chickenpox vaccine given all in the same day, you know, in the United States, that's recommended for the 12-month well baby visits. Their system just can't take that particular load, and in many, many cases, the children may already be compromised somewhat because of vaccines that they got earlier.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what would you say to parents who are scared of the potential here? They're uncertain. They might not have looked into everything themselves. It might be overwhelming for them to actually try to, you know, wrap their head around all these studies and whatnot. But maybe they come from a perspective where they really want to find out what to do, what is best concerning their children. What would you recommend to these parents?
Well, I'm not a healthcare professional. I didn't go to medical school. I'm not a medical doctor. But I would encourage parents to do as much research as they can possibly do on the internet and, you know, in other sources, and to have frank discussions with their healthcare professional. And, you know, whenever a medicine is given, the individual should always look at the packet insert of the medicine. And that packet insert will give you, you know, the pros and the cons. It will give you, vaccine side effects, you know, things that have been reported as adverse events from, you know, this particular medication or this particular vaccine. And so those need to be read. There's a lot of pressure. You know, you sit there and your healthcare professional has his or her hand on the doorknob ready to go, you know, wanting to go to the, you know, to the nurse or the medical assistant and say, okay, go ahead and vaccinate this child. And when you're sitting there reading the packet insert, then these individuals get impatient. And so what? Let them be impatient. Take your time, make the best decision. If you feel like you're being pressured by the healthcare professional, then, you know, I would read that pressure as negative. You know, then if your healthcare professional will not take the time with you for you to get properly educated regarding vaccine, and instead they start spouting dogma, then it's probably time for you to get a new healthcare professional.
Right, yeah. Now, are there, what we've been talking about so far in terms of what potentially could happen, are these any stated side effects on the packet inserts, as you know?
Absolutely. I think, I can't remember specifically which vaccine. I think it's the DTaP vaccine. It says that one of the side effects of the vaccine is autism.
There you go.
Directly on the packet insert.
Yeah.
So, and one of the side effects that's listed on the MMR vaccine is encephalopathy. And so, you know, basically, sickness of the brain. So when you read these packet inserts, you know, they're saying things that your healthcare provider is not telling you. They're saying things that not, you know, when you receive the vaccine in the United States, you have to sign an informed consent statement saying that you know about the risk and benefits of the vaccines. Oddly enough, this information is not on the informed consent statement. It's left off. It's only on the packet insert. And so I can't stress enough to parents that they educate themselves, that before any medication is given, including vaccines, that they look at the packet insert, that they look at it in detail, that they take it home and they read it and then make a healthcare decision based on what they see. Doctors will tell you, you know, that, oh, well, you're not going to understand that. It's written in, you know, medical language. That's a bunch of crap. You will be able to understand it. And if there's a term or something that you don't understand, look it up.
So they do this to immunize themselves, pun intended, from potential future lawsuits then, correct?
That is correct. You know, they want to make sure that you know, you're releasing the liability. And besides, it's almost impossible to sue a healthcare practitioner for a vaccine adverse event, okay, because they're doing, you know, what the court then will establish is say, oh, well, this is the proper standard of care, and we're just following this particular standard of care. So, you know, they then indemnify the healthcare professional. And obviously in the United States, vaccine manufacturers themselves are indemnified. It's pretty much impossible to sue a vaccine manufacturer for any type of adverse reaction. You have to go through the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is a long, contentious, drawn out, and expensive process.
Yeah. Now, what would you say are the risks in these days? Let's look at the United States then, for example, here, of attracting the diseases, the illnesses, et cetera, that the majority of these vaccines are supposed to immunize you against?
Well, the thing that I don't understand is that when you look at different countries and in countries that are having better health outcomes than the United States, you're finding that they vaccinate much less, that many nations specifically within the European Union are vaccinating, you know, they give a third of the vaccines or less that are given in the United States. When you look at the Scandinavian countries specifically, then, you know, they're giving maybe 11, 12 vaccines by the time a child is age 6. You know, France giving 17 vaccines by the time a child is age 6. But you just don't see the ravages of these, you know, horrible, these things that are described as just awful, deadly epidemics coming back and, you know, killing these individuals or ravaging these countries. So I don't think that the whole vaccines provide, you know, perfect protection against infectious disease, and that we need this perfect protection against infectious disease. I don't think that holds water.
Yeah, and even though we have less in Scandinavia, we still do have a rise of autism and other diseases that is, you know, believed to be due to vaccination and everything else. And I think it's more though in the United States. Where are the autism statistics? Have you been monitoring that, and how much that's been going up? Does it coincide with the vaccinations as well?
I have been monitoring the statistics and have watched autism incidents rise, you know, throughout the 1990s, into the 2000s, into the 2010s. The latest statistics are actually for children who were born in 2000. And it's odd because the CDC does not report statistics beyond this particular point, even though thimerosal was phased out in the early 2000s from the hepatitis B, the Haemophilus influenza and the DTaP vaccines, you know, before it was phased into the flu shot. The CDC does not report autism incidents after children born in 2000. For those particular children, the rate of autism is 1 in 68, and the rate of autism in boys is about 1 in 51.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's huge. I mean, 2% of all boys in the United States have autism. I mean, that's just ludicrous.
Yeah, how much is that if we do the numbers on that? That's, tens of thousands, maybe close to 100,000 or something like that?
Right. When you look at the statistics, the overall estimates, the United States has about 1.5 million autistic individuals.
Wow. There you go.
And so, you know, this is absolutely, you know, ludicrous. And some of the, you know, more conservative estimates are that, you know, this epidemic today costs the United States about 100, you know, and this is a conservative estimate, about $130 billion. Per year in terms of healthcare costs. And as more of these individuals have autism, as more of them are entering to the system, as more of them then become adults and they receive supplemental security income and things like that, and you know they require, some of them are going to require special housing and management, then the costs are going to go up.
Oh, absolutely. And you'd think then that the government would have an interest here of saying, well, let's look at this then because we don't want to spend more money. But it's not about that then, is it?
No, it is not about that. You know, I wish that the U.S. federal government would follow some level of logic here and see, you know, the rising costs of managing this epidemic. But no, you know, the issue is on the front end. The issue is the billion-dollar industry, you know, billions of dollars industry that the vaccine industry is in the United States.
Now, there's vaccines that occur throughout children's earlier, you know, years and up to a certain age and whatnot. And in some cases, it takes place in the schools. I remember that's where we got them in Sweden, was primarily through the school nurse administered these, and I don't believe that any of them were mandatory, but at the same time, they kind of make you, they give you that impression. They tell you that now it's time, this is what we do, this is going to happen. How are things in the United States? Is there any vaccinations that are mandatory?
There are the vaccine mandates come at the state level and not at the federal level, and right. there is some push by some of the pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine safety advocates that would want the mandates to be at the federal level. But it really, it's, you know, a lot of it varies depending on the state that you're in. You know, some states have only medical exemptions. Some states will have philosophical exemptions. Some states will have religious exemptions. And so, you know, it's very, very difficult. Even on top of that, then there's a lot of misinformation in school districts. Public health departments will tell you it's a flat-out mandate, and they won't tell you about the availability of the exemptions. You know, they'll misrepresent the law of that particular state. It happens all the time, you know, because they really want to pressure these individuals to get vaccinated because it's been drilled into them as healthcare professionals that vaccines are the best prevention against infectious disease, which I would contend is not true. And so, you know, they will misrepresent what the law states, and a lot of times children will get vaccinated and the parents won't even know that they have an option.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where people have to, you know, put their foot down and really look into it and say, you know, do I want this? And there's no obligation. If there's no obligation, and even if there is, there's, as you said, there's other ways to try to get out of it, even if you have to claim religious reasons or whatnot. That's the way to go then, you know. But, you know, personally, I'm very wary of so-called safe levels. We've seen these change back and forth. And as we know, things are accumulative in the body. Things, you know, add up after a while. And obviously, I'm one who doesn't want to have anything that potentially could be, you know, down the road leading to problems. But is it safer for adults with certain of these vaccines? I mean, in recent years, they've really started pushing, you know, the flu vaccines. And, you know, now we do have these other things breaking out. I mean, not even getting started on the Ebola thing here. But it's very possible that a vaccine down the road will be offered to people to go and protect themselves against this. But what would you say to adults in this situation in terms of if it's safer for them or not?
Well, the safety of the long-term effects of getting vaccines as adults has not been tested. The CDC just flat out, they don't even have the databases that are appropriate to test adverse events in adults. It doesn't exist. And so, you know, you're really playing, you're gambling when you get a vaccination as an adult. One of the studies that Dr. Thompson proposed, and he was actually told that he wasn't going to be permitted to do, was to look at the long-term effects of some aerosol exposure through the flu shot and its relationship to adult neurological disorders like Alzheimer's disease. And so he was told that he was not permitted to do that particular study. So nobody really has done that particular study in the federal government. There are some studies that link the aluminum in vaccines to Alzheimer's disease. And I would definitely say, you know, you have to look at the fact that when an individual gets a flu shot, that's 25 micrograms of mercury. If you look at the FDA safe limits for 25 micrograms of mercury, then the individual that got that vaccine should weigh 550 pounds or more, you know, over 200 kilos.
Wow.
And so this, you know, they're exceeding the safe limit for mercury. Why would you do that to yourself? And then the flu shot, even if you get a mercury free flu shot, then it is essentially untested. And there are also data that show that it's inefficacious, that it's really not providing you any benefit.
I mean, we've seen skyrocketing statistics of Alzheimer's in the you know, recent years. And I mean, that's kind of a industry in itself, all of these different epidemics that are occurring, and there's a lot of money being poured into it. It's and then they kind of seem not too willing to look at any of this kind of data, despite that they're getting, you know, millions in some cases, you know, in donations and things like that, look into it, try to, you know, solve it medically and whatnot. And you'd think that something that is so simple, so obvious, would be, you know, number one on the agenda, but it seems to be something that they absolutely avoid at all costs, right?
No, they will not look at it. And if you probe even deeper, they don't even have the infrastructure to allow them to look at it. And it's not that the infrastructure doesn't exist. You know, those databases could be easily assembled. It's just for lack of wanting to do the study. It's like the study that nobody wants to do. And there are instances, there are individuals in the CDC and the World Health Organization that have gone on record, usually in private, and said, oh, well, we don't want to do those studies because we really don't want to know the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. Now, are there any other people that have approached you or Dr. Wakefield or anything like that in terms of chiming in on this and speaking out themselves, having their conscience coming to the surface?
Not yet. The only individual that I've talked to directly is Dr. Thompson. And it's not for lack of trying. I would invite, you know, anybody that's listening to this show that's a government official or routinely will call out individuals that are potential whistleblowers and email them to see if they will give me some additional information. And it's not happening. And this is one of the things that Dr. Thompson even echoed when I was on, you know, with these phone conversations that I had with him, was that he felt all alone. He felt that, you know, the individuals around him in the CDC that were looking at vaccine safety were all, you know, drinking the same Kool-Aid, and that somehow, you know, he was not drinking that Kool-Aid and felt very, very lonely, and in some cases, you know, endured persecution because he was trying to raise these issues internally.
Well, it's very much like a tight-knit kind of religious community, I'd say. And if you do step out of bounds, you do become branded as a heretic pretty quick. What would you say to, have you seen those who are trying to, you know, debunk the aspect that you've been laying forth and whatnot, and other people as well in this, you know, movement, if we can call it that? that are trying to just bring attention to these points that we've been talking about so far. Are they successful in able to discredit what you're laying, what you're presenting? Because when I read some of that, it's more that they're focusing kind of, well, it's a conspiracy theory and it's all ridiculous, ergo, don't trust them, but it's not that much science that's backing this up. Am I correct?
That is correct. Usually the attacks that come, are ad hominem attacks. You know, people that will call me a wacko. You know, I've been branded as a part of what they call the Mercury Militia, and so you use these sort of hot button terms like militia, and they inspire these thoughts of, me collecting guns in my basement. And so it's all, very much designed to discredit me without specifically looking at the science. And I stand by my science. I recently, had this one paper regarding MMR and autism and the effect that I'm seeing in African-American males. It was published. It was then retracted. But I stand by that work. And, oddly enough, even though the paper was retracted, it reappeared on the journal. The journal's name is Translational Neurodegeneration. It reappeared on the journal's website on October 21st. So you can get my retracted article. But again, on the outside, outside of the CDC, the attacks are, very, very personal. They're very, very vicious. And, it's almost like, akin to like religious persecution.
Oh, definitely. Give us the website. What can people, or what can they Google for to find the paper, Brian?
Just Google Translational Neurodegeneration. The website itself is just all one word, translationalneurodegeneration.com. And if you scroll down, then you'll see my paper.
All right, excellent. Well, what's the reason why they put it back up then? What's the reasoning there?
Wow, I wish I knew. I have no idea why, that paper is back up. Perhaps it's a matter of conscience that they still want this information available. The journal has gone back and forth. When I first heard that the paper was possibly going to be retracted, this was back on August 27th, and they took it down from the website. Then I asked the publishers of the journal to provide a, scientific basis for doing this. And I got this very oddly worded half-page review. When I received that review, then I sent back a 10-page rebuttal. I analyzed the data every which way that they could be analyzed. And, oddly enough, it made no difference. The journal dismissed, my rebuttal. They thanked me for it, and they said, well, we're going to retract your paper anyway. And so then it was, it was officially retracted on October 3rd of this year, but then strangely, reappeared on the website. And my only guess is that they received a lot of pressure from entities like the CDC, the World Health Organization, the pharmaceutical industry, and so they received pressure to, retract this paper, which is really unprecedented.
The paper is called Measles, Mumps, Rubella Vaccination, Timing and Autism Among Young African-American Boys, a reanalysis of CDC data. It's up there. We'll obviously link to it. We'll link to the main website, as Brian mentioned as well, so you guys out there can read this for yourself. Now, is it across the board among all races, or was this just studied on African-American boys, or how does it play out there?
Well, it's very interesting. The effect that I saw regarding the timing of the MMR vaccine, when you look at the entire population that was in this study, so it was, all races, males and females, that were specifically in five different school districts in metropolitan Atlanta. When you look at the population as a whole, there was a slight effect that was statistically significant. But then as I drilled down and I looked at different populations, the entirety of the effect came from African-American males. And so those African-American males that were received the MMR vaccine prior to 36 months of age were three and a half times more likely to get an autism diagnosis versus those African-American males that got the MMR vaccine after 36 months of age. So it was really, it was a very, very strong effect. It was statistically significant every way that I ran the data. But then, oddly enough, and I haven't published these data yet, the CDC also considered those kids that they said they had isolated autism. And so these were kids that had no prior diagnosis. They weren't diagnosed with any type of other impairments. The only diagnosis that they got was autism. And when you look at those data, you also see a very, very strong statistically significant effect specific to males. And these are children, you know, that evidently, you know, when you look at their medical histories, at least the medical history that I can put together from my data set, these were individuals that did not have any prior diagnosis and then and seemed to be developing normally and then regressed into autism.
And so How quick was that?
It's very difficult to tell, you know, how quickly the autism diagnosis. We don't have the date that they were specifically diagnosed with autism, so we can't really tell. We just know that based on the data that we have, these individuals appear to be developing normally prior to their first birthday.
Right, right. What was it again? It was something I forget now. I talked about it earlier, but it escapes me. It was something the critics of this discussed in terms of the birth certificates. What was that again? Can you remind me about that?
That is such a bizarre thing that they did to hide this effect for African Americans. The CDC saw the effect, and Dr. Thompson specifically, he was the one that was doing the statistics and running the statistical programs. He saw and reported the effects for African Americans on November 7th of 2001. And so he reported this to his superiors. And then his superiors told him that, well, why don't you, when you consider race, why don't you limit the individuals in the study to only those that could produce a valid state of Georgia birth certificate? Okay. Mm-hmm. And what that did was that eliminated 40% of the children within the study. Okay. And so then Dr. Thompson dutifully went back and ran those particular statistics on African Americans, on whites and other races, and the statistically significant relationship went away. And, you know, everybody knows, you know, if you've had any experience with statistics, you know that a larger sample size is much, much better, and it gives you much more information than if you have a smaller sample size. So what essentially the CDC strategy was to limit, to get rid of 40% of these individuals in order to make that relationship go away. They had a smaller sample size, they had less statistical power, and that relationship went away. But when you go back, there is absolutely no rationale to limit that analysis to individuals that had a valid state of Georgia birth certificate. There's no reason, there's no difference in these particular populations. And even if you look at the original protocol that the CDC laid out, they essentially violated, the original protocol said that when they considered race, that they were going to consider it for the entire population in the study, not just those individuals that had Georgia birth certificates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there you go. And there's, of course, a risk nonetheless across the board for this. And it's, you know, it's still something I think everyone should be, you know, very often. Do you want to, I mean, your son suffered from this as well, so I understand that that's very, you know, very difficult for you emotionally. Is there anything you've been able to do in terms of reversing these effects, or are they permanent as far as you are concerned?
We've been able to reverse some of the effects. You know, one of the biggest issues that children that are vaccine injured like this and they regress into, you know, quote unquote autism, is that they're in physical pain. You know, a lot of times there's gut pain, there's head pain. You know, some of them feel like their skin's crawling. There's joint pain, and my son has shown evidences. He's nonverbal, so he can't tell us, but he's shown evidences of all sorts of, aches and pains and, in some instances, outright debilitating pain, that he was exhibiting. So our first and foremost, approach was to address these issues that were causing him such severe pain. And so, we did dietary interventions that were very, very good. He, for a while he was off of gluten and casein. So he was on a wheat-free, dairy-free diet, which was very good, and it helped heal his gut. It helped heal his bowel. He was, he was in intense pain, prior to being able to do that. And we saw a huge, huge difference based on that. We've also worked, to get the mercury out. And when we started to do interventions, then mercury, came pouring out of his system. We would look at the excretion in his hair, the excretion in his urine and feces, and we would see huge levels of mercury coming out of his system.
Really? And so you could visually see that?
Basically, we trim some of the hair and then do an analysis on it.
Right, yep.
And then also, same thing, we do like a 24-hour urine catch, or then look at fecal material, and you just send it off to the lab, and they would analyze the mercury that was coming out.
Wow. Well, there you go. Well, I mean, there's a number of natural things. I guess we mentioned them in passing before on the program, like, chlorella, zeolite, and other, natural ways of trying to bind the mercury and get it out of your system in some capacity. Do you have anything to recommend for people who, I mean, this is good to do anyway, because, there's a lot of mercury in the fish these days. And I think it's, in some cases, it's not even only the vaccines. It's since these are accumulative things, and since they are in our environment in different places, this could potentially happen to anybody who ingests too much or, in any capacity. So what would you recommend to get it out?
Well, there's a variety of things, and it turns out that, different things will work on different children, and different things are difficult for different children. What may be, we looked at stuff like DMPS. They tended to be irritating on my son's system, so we, settled on DMSA and glutathione and N-acetylcysteine. Which was extremely helpful. We have used chlorella. Chlorella was very helpful, and it's also very benign.
Yeah.
It's not tough on the system. Some of these strong chelators, it's almost like the child's on chemo. You do a couple of days on and a few days off. And so my advice to parents, again, I'm not a medical professional, but to, find a practitioner that will, work with you and find specifically what is going to work best, for your child. Not only from a standpoint of being able to excrete the mercury, but also from a standpoint what is going to, keep them as comfortable as possible. I mean, you don't want to take, something that's an irritant and put it directly on the skin or have a child ingest it. Every child is going to react differently.
Well, exactly. And that's why I think ultimately as natural as possible is the way to go. And in some cases, unfortunately, it might not be enough, though, because it might be, too much we're dealing with. And but it's over time, too. That's another thing. It takes the body time. In some cases, I know the chlorella is something you can take for the periods of over a year, maybe even more, actually. And over time, it's something that aids in the process. And hopefully, the child or whoever will begin to feel better due to that. So there are solutions. It's not, means that it's over by any capacity, but it still, go back to the central point here, it still means that a tremendous amount of damage has been done and is being done to these children. So what is next in the process here? What needs to occur now, Brian, for this to be completely blown open, for more people to begin to look at this, to recognize the problem, and just with a sincere, inquisitive mind, begin to asking the real fundamental questions. Is this good? Is it not? Why are there, autism epidemics on the rise around the world?
Right. I, I would say, you know, the best things that are happening and the best things that could happen are at the grassroots level, that individuals demand that their healthcare practitioners listen to them regarding vaccination and regarding vaccination choice. And for those individuals that do not listen, then, you know, drive them out of business. They, you know, if more and more individuals are demanding this type of modern, you know, point of care medicine, you know, not one size fits all medicine, but point of care medicine that's individualized to, you know, your particular child or you or any of your family members, then, you know, these healthcare practitioners are going to be forced to listen. You know, I wish I could say that I had faith in the federal government to, you know, investigate this and look at this, but it's, their track record has been poor at best.
Yeah.
At looking, you know, and even when, you know, reports have come out that have been scathing, nothing happens. Nothing is, you know, there's no consequences. There's no recourse, and specifically with the Centers for Disease Control, we have an agency that's out of control that is recommending more and more vaccines on an already bloated vaccination schedule. And when you look at the healthcare outcomes, the overall healthcare outcomes in the United States and where we stand, you know, with developed countries in the world, it's extremely poor.
Oh, definitely. It's a numbers game, as many things are, to a certain extent. And the more people that do talk about this, that try to be, you know, loud about it, bring attention to it, and the better it would be, obviously. I guess it's the same thing there. It's never a one-size-fits-all, but definitely more people need to be aware of it and pressure the government, ultimately, even if it's not, you know, the final solution to, you know, getting out of this problem, per se. I think trying as many different avenues as possible is what needs to take place, correct?
That is correct, and you know, I'm looking and actively recruiting other scientists to come forward that will publish peer-reviewed work that will be in reputable journals, and more, you know, and also looking for more and more journals that will stand by good science rather than, you know, bowing to, you know, the dogma of large pharmaceutical interests or the CDC. And so, you know, there are journals out there that will publish this work. There are reputable journals out there that will publish this work. And so, you know, the science is out there. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, the science will continue to be out there. And there are, you know, brave souls that are publishing this work, and they're doing very, very good work, and they're not really afraid of, you know, the collateral damage that would be associated with that. And so I think that's really, really important because, you know, the CDC, large pharmaceutical interests, even healthcare practitioners will lie and say, oh, well, the science has already spoken. Well, when you look at the science for thimerosal, there's 165 peer-reviewed papers at least out there that show the dangers of thimerosal specifically to neurological tissues. And on the other side, those papers that say that thimerosal is safe, there's about 14.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Again, we're back to that scenario where there's plenty of studies out there. There's plenty of science on it, but for some reason, it's just people are not, you know, doing what's right here. What else should we know about this story? Be that of, you know, Dr. William Thompson, the CDC, or any other involved parties. What are some of the major things we've left out so far here, Brian?
Let me think. I do want to address, you know, it's interesting because in some respects, I've come under fire because I did record several of the phone conversations with Dr. Thompson, and there are some snippets of you know, that have been produced in, you know, they've been included in videos of recorded conversations with Dr. Thompson. You know, when I did that very cautiously and with trepidation. You know, that.
Yeah.
I was legally recording these phone conversations. No, Dr. Thompson did not know that he was being recorded in four specific phone conversations, but they were all done legally, and they were all done at the advice of several others. And I would not have done something like that if the information hadn't been so compelling. You know, it was really basically to save children from going, having to go through, you know, a lifetime of debilitating, you know, out and out pain And so it was not an easy decision. And, you know, out of the dozens of conversations that I had with Dr. Thompson, you know, over this 10-month time period that we spoke on the phone, only four of those conversations were recorded.
Right. So there's potentially a lot more to it that we haven't heard either.
No, there's a lot to it. There's a lot of notes. I mean, this is really the tip of the iceberg as to, you know, what has been revealed. So, you know, we've started. There's other science that I need to get out there and publish that, you know, things that were, I was tipped off by the whistleblower regarding this. And so, you know, therefore, you know, this is not, you know, what the public has seen so far, is, you know, it's not the end of it. And as, you know, I feel like it's my duty to make this information available because, people that are making informed healthcare decisions need to know.
Well, you know, sometimes the truth, does hurt. Actually, in most cases, it hurts and you kind of need to, you know, rip that Band-Aid off, tough love in a way. But at the same time, of course, we hope that everything's okay with Dr. William Thompson and that he's not ended up in a position where he's, you know, losing his job or threatened or, you know, there is a number of things that could occur due to this. The CDC is a massive organization. There's a lot of money involved here. There's a lot of, you know, parties that have stakes in this game, unfortunately. And as we know, it's... If it's a corruption on this level already, then you know it speaks volumes. That's my point about what length they're willing to go to get their money and to get their job done to get this agenda through. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, there's you know, I would not doubt that, you know, Dr. Thompson's life would be at stake, as well as his livelihood. So, you know, my hope and prayer for him is that he, you know, remains protected and also that there isn't backlash regarding his career, you know, because of him being forthcoming. I know that, you know, in my conversations with him, when the MMR paper was finally published and came out in print, he was relieved. He was absolutely relieved, yeah. You know, and felt vindicated that the truth was coming out. So, you know, a lot of this was very good for him. You know, this stuff, you know, all this hiding and lying really was weighing on his soul. And so when this came forward, he was, you know, actually glad. I mean, I don't think he enjoyed the attention. I think that he was, you know, concerned for his family, but, you know, it's not easy to do the right thing.
Well, it's kind of a chess game too, right? Because if the CDC would fire him now, that would kind of speak volumes in itself, wouldn't it?
It would speak volumes in itself, and I don't think the CDC would fire him because if the CDC did fire him, he basically had carte blanche to say whatever he wanted.
Exactly. So now they can keep him, you know, under wraps, basically. Well, he's very brave, and of course he should have tremendous... you know, credit for what he's done so far, and so should you for helping to facilitate this and bring this forward. Now, could it be that it's maybe also, it's not that many more people that know the information within the CDC? Maybe it's a very compartmentalized, I don't know if you know anything about the structure in there or how this occurs, but it could literally be, as it is in some cases, a handful of people that have, you know, access to the studies or really looked into it and have that as their job to look at this. And maybe that's one of the reasons why we have so few people speaking out about this. What do you think?
I would say it's more systemic. I look at, you know, some of the author lists for some of the publications and, you know, some of the publications the CDC has put out to indemnify vaccines and vaccine components. There are 20 or more authors on these particular papers. And so, you know, one of the things that Dr. Thompson described was if somebody did fall out of line and if somebody was, you know, questioning, then what the CDC would do, you know, with these valid scientific questions that needed thought and concerns, they would turn it into a personnel problem. And so if an individual did raise a question, then instead of addressing that question, you know, from a scientific basis, then they would notify HR. You know, human relations then would step in and they would recommend counseling.
or recommend that this person take a leave of absence, or, something of this regard. So they were able to, censor scientific concerns by turning them into personnel matters and saying, oh, well, you there must be something wrong with you because you're falling out of line with the status quo and you're questioning vaccine safety.
Now, is there any prospect to set up some kind of, independent CDC? I mean, I know there are a lot of people, independent organizations, websites, and groups of people that are already in some capacity doing this, but at the same time, something that could kind of carry that weight, where maybe more of these folks have gone together and really try to put themselves in opposition to what they see have occurred here. What do you think?
I would like to see, there are some independent organizations. The problem is that there's a lot of force and inertia in the blogosphere, pro-pharmaceutical blogosphere, that will, if an organization stands up, even as an independent organization, and starts to, question the safety and efficacy of vaccines, then, you're automatically branded. What I would like to see happen in the federal government is vaccine safety being taken out of the CDC and vaccine safety actually taken out all the way out of the Department of Health and Human Services, because there's a huge conflict of interest. In the United States, we have the Federal Aviation Administration, which, is in charge of, aviation across the country. But then the governing body regarding safety, the National Transportation Safety Board, is completely out of the FAA. They are independent, and they have no skin in the game, regarding the airline industry. And so I don't see why something like that couldn't happen in the CDC, where vaccine safety would be taken completely out of the mix. So there isn't the financial inertia, there isn't the pressure and dogma regarding protection against infectious disease, so they can independently look at vaccine safety and do all these retrospective studies to make sure that the current vaccination that we schedule is both safe and efficacious.
Now, before we wrap up here, please let us know if there's anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the story or about yourself also. I mean, also let us know how people can get a hold of you, contact you. You mentioned urging people to, speak out. And if we do have anybody listening in that capacity, how can they reach you, Brian?
The easiest thing to do is to get my contact information by Googling Simpson University. That's where I'm located. I'm an associate professor of biology here. And so, they can get my contact information, they can email me, even my phone number, my desk phone is given out, and I'm more than happy to work with individuals, to work with parents that are concerned. I do, stress I'm not a medical professional, so I don't really give out medical advice, and I always encourage people to talk, have these frank, uncomfortable discussions with their medical professionals. But I do welcome people, if you want to get a hold of me, I would welcome that and do want to help so people can make informed decisions.
All right, very good. Simpson University, check that out. I'll see if we can add a link to that as well. Well, thanks, Brian, for coming on. I mean, you're very brave, and I think it's a shame that people are, attempting to do assassination to a certain extent here and fling mud at you for what you're doing and whatnot. But, as we know, they have their stake in the game as well. They have their own objectives and agenda, and I think at the end of it we have to do what's right, and you're doing what you believe is right, and I commend you for that. So please keep up the good work, keep doing what you're doing, and if you're right here, then what you're doing is going to save a lot of people's lives and a lot of their health. So I think it's worth it at the end of the day, don't you?
Well, I do. That's why I do what I do, and that's why so many others that are so brave are continuing to do this type of work, and I appreciate what you're doing as well.
We want to thank you for listening today and for getting informed about this issue, a very important subject. I hope that you take it to heart and learn more about it if you are uncertain about vaccine safety. We spoke about it on prior shows, and there's a lot of data there, so please do a search in our archives and you'll find more. We'll be back in a few days with Arthur Topham from Canada regarding his legal case and how he has been targeted for his opinions, for his writing on his website by the Canadian government and the lobby groups that wield power to have the state go after people for what they write on their own personal websites. We also have Daniel Hammarberg, Jason Erb, Neil Kramer, Carlos Morales, and Lawrence Eastman, to name a few. The website is redicecreations.com, and to subscribe, go to redicemembers.com. Have a great rest of your day. Please take care, stay healthy and focused, and we'll speak to you again in just a few days.